We have a few different bills we're going to be hearing this morning. I'd like to ask Attorney General Hardy Myers if you want to come up and kind of give us an overview, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I want to take just a few moments before the subcommittee begins hearings on specific measures to give the subcommittee a very brief backdrop of the proposals. We know from the work of our Crime Victims Assistance Section that one of the key frustrations of crime victims in Oregon has been the inability to recover economic losses that occur as a result of criminal offenses. And to address that issue, in 2001, I formed what we've called the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force in order to seek improvement of policy in the overall area of criminal offender restitution. The first effort of the task force was to strengthen the basic policy in Oregon law relating to offender accountability for restitution. Prior to the 2003 legislative session, Oregon law had basically provided that offenders would be subjected to a restitution obligation depending upon their ability to pay. And so the percentage of cases in which restitution was actually ordered was relatively small. So the key proposal that emerged from the first round of the Restitution Reform Task Force's work, which came into the 2003 regular session, was to change the basic policy in Oregon to essentially provide that restitution was to be ordered in all cases, and that the ability of the offender to pay would not be a factor in whether restitution was to be awarded, but was to be a factor in determining the schedule for the payment of the restitution obligation. A really fundamental shift of policy. The foundation shift, as the task force sought for remaining work to seek to improve the accountability system, the criminal accountability system, so far as it related to restitution liability. With that foundation change in place, the next round of work of the task force through this prior biennium, our interim, has been to seek to improve the overall law and policy structure as it bears on restitution liability, and to sharpen and to increase accountability for restitution in the practical sense. In other words, the ability to actually recover the restitution awarded, and to see that it reaches the victims to whom it has been awarded. That, Mr. Chair and members, is a brief kind of historical context of the proposals that you will begin hearing this morning. We appreciate very much the subcommittee's taking time on its agenda to consider them. They represent the very carefully thought through work of the task force, multidisciplinary task force, through this past biennium, and we look forward to working with the subcommittee in your considerations. Thank you very much.
Great. Are there any questions that I'd like to ask? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the first witnesses, Fred Boss and Walt Begley. House Bill 2231 will call a hearing. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if Connie Gallagher, the director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section, may also come forward.
Sure. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Connie Gallagher. I'm the Director of Crime Victims Assistance with the Oregon Department of Justice. The three bills that you will be hearing today are part of a long-term effort underway by the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Work Group, as you just heard the Attorney General mention. This group has recognized that the policy of Oregon that's articulated in 419C.450 that states that it is the policy of the State of Oregon to encourage and promote the payment of restitution and other obligations by youth offenders as well as by adult offenders, along with Article 1, Section 42 of the Oregon Constitution, which states that victims are entitled to prompt restitution, is simply not descriptive of practice today within the criminal justice system. The three bills that you'll be hearing about today request a modification of current statutes which contradict this fundamental policy already in law. The bills support the fundamental belief that the burden for financial harm should rest with the perpetrator of the crime rather than with the victim of crime. House Bill 2231 deals with record expunction. And actually, this bill is a product of discussions that began last session. While strengthening the legal requirement that the harm that's caused to a victim should be reflected in the restitution judgment, it was discovered that there's nothing to prevent a perpetrator, whether a juvenile or an adult, to request that the court expunge the adult conviction or the juvenile adjudication, even though there is an unsatisfied criminal restitution judgment. Now, the process of setting aside a conviction or an adjudication has many different steps. And quite frankly, it's very easy to overlook an unsatisfied restitution judgment in the course of looking at all the other aspects of setting aside a conviction or an adjudication. For this reason, a specific prohibition is needed in order to be sure that this element of a perpetrator's criminal act, that is, the payment of financial damages to a victim, is not overlooked. It's for that reason that we ask for your support on House Bill 2231.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2231. As the Attorney General testified, House Bill 2231 is a product of the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. It is designed to plug a potential loophole in the restitution laws where a convicted criminal or an adjudicated juvenile may avoid paying the full amount of restitution to the victim of their crime by seeking an expungement of the judgment. This bill provides that satisfaction of the restitution judgment is a condition precedent to the application for expungement. I'll be happy to answer any questions should the members have any.
Any questions? Yes.
When somebody gets a zero-tolerance sentence when they don't pay restitution that they're supposedly going to be sent to prison, if they're sent to prison, are they then relieved of paying restitution?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, no. If there is a judgment that awards a restitution to the victim, the fact that the perpetrator or the defendant goes to prison has no effect on the judgment of restitution.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. In my experience, oftentimes, the judge, if there was a termination or a termination of probation, either successful or unsuccessful, and no more post-prison supervision term or a limited term of post-prison supervision, what I would often experience was judges referring the remaining money owed to the Department of Revenue. And I'm wondering, assuming for the sake of argument that the termination was a successful termination of probation and all that was left was this DOR, fines to DOR, does this statute cover that instance?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, this House Bill 2231 is only directed at the expungement of the judgment. So when applying for an expungement, the defendant or the adjudicated juvenile must show that they have satisfied the restitution award.
even if it's been referred to the Department of Revenue?
Yes. Yes.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the House Judiciary Subcommittee, my name is Walt Beglaw, and I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of House Bill 2231. This is a necessary and sensible refinement to provide restitution to victims of crime. In criminal law, restitution is a fundamental right of victims to make them whole, and should receive and does receive priority over other financial obligations. And second, this is a fundamental obligation of an offender for accountability. Perhaps nothing is more important, and in my years of representing victims, this is one principal goal they seek, is to be made whole from this. House Bill 2231 enhances those two principles by closing any conceivable loophole in the expungement statute for adult offenders and their juvenile counterparts. The expungement simply allows an individual in certain offenses to seal their conviction from public view. It is a privilege, a conditional privilege, afforded only to an offender who has fulfilled his or her obligations to the court, and restitution ought to be one of those express conditions. So I'm in support of this, and the association is. This, I might note that this bill actually provides an incentive to offenders to pay their restitution, to be productive, to be contributing in an expedited way. And so I think it's an excellent refinement when the expungement statute is utilized.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, Mr. Steve Dole, who is the president of Crime Victims United, had intended to be here today, but for health reasons he cannot. He did ask that I share with the committee the support of Crime Victims United for this bill.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, if we may address then also House Bill 2232 and House Bill
2233.
We'll have different. We may have different witnesses. So,
okay, thank you.
Ms. Skye.
Good morning, Chair Parker, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Skye, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose House Bill 2231. I did not submit written testimony on this bill, but I did submit written testimony on two of the other bills, and the related bill is 2237, and many of the same reasons that I wrote about in my testimony for House Bill 2237 apply to this bill. I think it's important when we, if we're going to talk about expungement, that we go back to the reasons why we have expungement. A person who commits a crime that is eligible for expungement under this statute, that being a violation, a misdemeanor, or a Class C felony, if that person stays out of trouble then for 10 years, they fully comply with the sentence, they are eligible for expungement under current law. They file for expunction. They are required to submit their fingerprints to the state police and pay an $80 fee, which allows the state police to check and make sure they haven't been in trouble anywhere else in the country. And they are required to serve a copy of their request for expungement on the district attorney's office. The district attorney's office then has an opportunity to review anything that they know about this individual and to object. And if the district attorney's office objects, then a hearing is held in front of the court and the court makes the decision.
You don't want to see
it. I think what we need to keep track of is the reason why we have expungement, and that is because people make mistakes, and we in Oregon have recognized that if someone makes a mistake, their sentence, they fully comply with that sentence, and they stay out of trouble for 10 years, that on a policy level, they should be able to have a conviction removed from their record. Why is it a good idea to allow people to be able to remove a conviction from their record? Well, a criminal conviction on someone's record can often be a bar to employment or to improving your employment situation, to moving up in the employment world. It can often be a bar to obtaining housing, and it can be a bar to entering the military, working for law enforcement. There are all kinds of reasons that people want to get a conviction expunged. These are not people who have gone out and gotten in trouble again. They're not people who willfully did not comply with their sentence. They're people who have done everything that's been expected of them. And what we're talking about here is really only going to affect the poor people who have done everything that's been expected of them. Those poor people who were unable to pay the entire amount of their restitution. I think it's important that we look at the language of the statute, and on line 7 of the bill, you can see the language that requires that the defendant has fully complied with and performed the sentence of the court. That includes restitution. Case law is very clear that restitution is a part of the sentence. Now, because we don't have debtor's prison in Oregon, a court cannot jail somebody for not paying restitution unless they find that it's a willful violation. So oftentimes, if an offender is not paying their restitution, they'll be brought before the court for a probation violation hearing, and they will be required to prove to the court whether or not they actually have the ability to pay. And in fact, the restitution statute, as amended last session, allows the court to consider their ability to pay. So if you have an offender who has caused some property damage to someone, say it was a hit and run, and they totaled the other person's vehicle, and it happened to be a Mercedes, so they have a $30,000 restitution judgment, but they also happen to be on public assistance, either because they are a single parent or because they're disabled, they don't have the ability to pay that entire $30,000. The court is required to set a payment schedule that can be met by them. And if they don't make their minimum payments that the court sets, and say it's $50 per month, if you pay $50 per month for the maximum amount of time you can be on probation, you will not pay that $30,000 judgment. It is then made into a judgment and referred to the Department of Revenue, as Ms. Moe had mentioned. Now that person has say that they have successfully completed their probation, because that's the only way they're going to be eligible for expunction under the current statute. They've fully complied with their sentence. They've not made a willful violation, meaning they've paid everything that they had the ability to pay. They've been successfully terminated from probation. 10 years down the road, they're off public assistance. They're trying to better their life. They're trying to get a good job, and they've got this criminal conviction. Along with it, they have a judgment in the Department of Revenue, and if that person ever gets an inheritance or wins the lottery or gets any tax refund whatsoever, it's going to be taken by the Department of Revenue. That judgment's always going to be there. But this change in the law will keep them from ever being able to expunge their conviction unless they get rich and they pay off that judgment. That wrongfully, disproportionately impacts the poor. And it's only the poor now who are not going to be able to get their convictions expunged. And the poor who fully comply with every other portion of their sentence. I think it's wrong to refer to this as a loophole, because it's not a loophole. The policy behind expungement is that if a person successfully completes their sentence, that they ought to be able to better themselves. They can stay out of trouble for long enough. They ought to be able to better themselves. This compounds a problem with what happened with the restitution statute last session, and that is, as the Department of Justice mentioned earlier, they strengthened the restitution statute to require that a court impose the entire judgment. So say, for instance, the example I've given you where the person's got the $30,000 judgment. Well, the victim whose car was wrecked was probably covered by insurance. that insurance company now steps in and says, we want our $30,000 that we paid to that victim. So that judgment that's hanging out there that will stop this person from getting their conviction expunged is a judgment that's going to be paid to an insurance company. The court, in the first place, had no ability to reduce that amount of restitution in light of the person's situation because they're no longer allowed to take ability to pay into account. So if you take the ability to pay factor out of the award up front, you can't then take it out at the end because what you're doing is you're shutting out every person who is not privileged and does not have financial resources to pay off their debts. And the only people who are ever going to be eligible for expungement are people who have financial resources. It may have constitutional implications under the Equal Protection Doctrine and the Equal Privileges and Immunities Doctrines. The proponents, when they changed the statute before to require full restitution, OCDLA was here to object and to point out the fact that there are juveniles who make a mistake when they're a juvenile and end up with a big restitution bill. That's a judgment that's going to follow them around for the rest of their lives. Should the conviction follow them around for the rest of their lives if they've made one mistake? Disabled folks, as I mentioned. As Ms. Gallagher, she looked as a reason that this is necessary is the fact that it's easy to overlook an outstanding restitution judgment when expungement is requested. I want to emphasize that in order to be eligible for expungement, the person applying for expungement is required to serve upon the DA a copy of that request. In Multnomah County, where I practice, the DA's office reviews every single one of those requests and they object to every single one that has an outstanding financial obligation. They do their job, they bring that information to the court at a hearing, and the court has the ability to look at, well, did this person do everything that they could while they were on supervision? Did they pay everything that they could pay? Then the court can still expunge that if they find that they successfully complied with the sentence. To say that we need to change this law because restitution is overlooked is to say that the district attorney's office or the judge not doing their job is a reason that we need to tie the court's hands and not allow them to expunge a conviction where they think the person deserves it and where they think that the person is going to be able to better their situation. The court needs to be able to expunge that conviction. The prosecutor always has the ability to bring this forward, and we should not change the law if they're not doing their job and if they're overlooking these outstanding convictions. It's very important to keep in mind that two things. The person has to comply with their sentence. This is not a loophole to get out of complying with the sentence. They have to pay every amount that they are able to pay. Two, that judgment will always be outstanding. If this offender has the conviction lifted, goes to medical school, becomes a doctor, a wealthy doctor, that judgment will be satisfied. But if this conviction keeps them from ever being able to increase their employment, to go to higher education, and to actually have a possibility of satisfying then that judgment will hang out there forever. So OCDLA opposes making expungement difficult to impossible for the poorest of the criminal defendants.
The argument on the other side of this is, of course, making the victim whole again. And if I had an old Mercedes, it was only worth $30,000. Somebody ran into it. But the question comes up, so somebody does get through and get their record expunged, and they can say, I don't owe you any money because I didn't do this crime. Never occurred. It's off the record. Is that true, or does the debt still hang over them?
Well, Chair Barker, I will confess that I'm not an expert in collections. Having been a public defender all my life, I don't do that. But I will say that once something is reduced to a criminal judgment, defenses to criminal judgments have already been dealt with. And perhaps Representative McPherson, who is a civil lawyer, would know a little bit more about this. But the conviction is separate from the judgment. And just as it is now, people get their convictions expunged. They can't go back. I mean, the judgment's still out there. It's going to be out there, and it's already been entered into judgment and would be entered into judgment long before they're eligible for expungement.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just as a comment on that, although it's not my area of practice, I do believe that the existence of the judgment is not affected by the act of expungement of the criminal record. So I don't think it eliminates the obligation. But my question is, I'm a little unclear on what the state of the law is now. That is, apparently it requires an affirmative action on the part of the prosecutor to come forward to oppose the expungement on the ground that restitution has not been paid, and then the court can take that into account but is not bound to. Is that a fair summary of the way it works now?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, the district attorney's office gets served a copy of the expungement. Now, there may be, I don't think that the law requires them to speak one way or the other, but they are given an opportunity to. That's why we're required to serve notice upon them. As for the court's obligation, the court is obliged to follow the statute, and so the court would have to look at this and determine whether the person fully complied with their sentence, and that they would have the court file before them. They would know if the person was placed on supervision, be it probation, or if the person goes to prison, their supervision would be after prison. It would be post-prison supervision. In either event, payment of all financial obligations is always a condition of that supervision. And in the current restitution statute, the court or the supervising agency can take the ability to pay into account when setting a payment schedule. However, there are statutory maximums for how long a person can be held on supervision. If you have, you know, a $200,000 judgment, you can't be held on supervision for the rest of your life because you haven't been able to complete your payments. You can only be held for the maximum amount of time, which for probation is 5 years.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So the law before our changes, I think, in the last session, was that ability to pay was an element in whether restitution would be ordered, whether a judgment of restitution would be entered, and then that element was eliminated from the process of quantifying the loss and imposing the judgment. But if I'm hearing you right, what happens now is that ability to pay is an element in whether or not the satisfaction of the restitution judgment is required before expungement of the record is granted. Is that a fair summary?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, ability to pay is a factor in determining the payment schedule, and complying with the payment schedule is what gets you to satisfactory completion of your supervision or your sentence as required by the statute. So in other words, the example I used earlier, if they look at your finances and decide you can only pay $50 a month, we can't, you know, and we recognize you're not going to get to the $30,000 by the end of 5 years, but we're going to require you to pay $50 a month because that's all you can pay on Social Security. And so they do that. They faithfully pay their $50 every month, and admittedly not many people do, but the person that does is the person who's going to be hurt by this bill. They pay their $50 a month. They get to the end of probation. They've done everything that they're supposed to do. Probation terminated successfully. Sentence fully complied with, because there's been no willful violation. They've done everything that they can do. You can't get blood from a turnip. So probation is terminated successfully, and the balance is referred as a judgment that remains outstanding. In those cases, a judge can say, well, look, you did everything that you could do, and you fully complied with your sentence. Therefore, I'm going to expunge this, and the judgment already remained outstanding. The judge at expunction doesn't do anything about outstanding judgments. Now, if the district attorney comes in and says, well, they were ordered to pay $50 a month and they may be on Social Security, but they never paid their $50 a month, or they only paid it once every six months, and then they didn't fully comply with their sentence, and they're not eligible for expunction.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? What about the argument that this might encourage somebody to go ahead and pay up and get that taken care of so they can get, I mean, maybe work a little harder to, so that they could get expungement? It might encourage them to pay the victim who is at loss in this event. I mean, I don't like to lose sight of the victim in these discussions.
Chair Barker, my response to that is that if they have money, they'll be motivated by that. But if they don't, they won't. And oftentimes, for the poor, a huge judgment like that can be so overwhelming that if it's going to be a bar to removing a criminal conviction, it's going to be a bar to employment, it's going to be a bar to housing. So I understand the committee's concern. I also want to remind the committee that when the bill last session took out the ability of the court to consider ability to pay, it also took out the court's ability to consider who the victim is. And as I pointed out, sometimes it is a person who wasn't covered by insurance and it's money out of their pocket. And that's an unfortunate situation. But frequently it can be a corporation or an insurance company. And those were the cases where courts were looking at the victim and were frequently saying, what was your deductible? And they were ordering the offender, no matter how poor they were, to pay the out-of-pocket expenses of the victim. But then looking at the balance between requiring a single mother of four on welfare to pay a $30,000 judgment to an insurance company and saying, I'm not going to require that because you don't have the ability to pay it. And they were making those balancing judgments oftentimes depending on who the victim was. And the victim is not always a person who has out-of-pocket expenses. So because we took that ability away from the court up front, I think it's especially important now not to take it away at the end.
Other questions? We'll move to a work session on House Bill 2231. I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, I move that House Bill 2231, Mr. Chair, be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And I'll carry the bill. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2232. So, Mr. Boss and Baglaw and Ms. Gallagher again, please. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of Crime Victims Assistance for the Oregon Department of Justice. As you've heard, when a person becomes a victim of crime and is financially burdened through no fault of their own, they turn to the court to uphold justice and support this concept of restitution for the economic losses that they have incurred as a result of crime. If the perpetrator of that crime is found to be competent to stand trial, admits to the facts of the case, The victim expects the court to formally acknowledge that the perpetrator of this act has also caused specific economic damages to that victim through their conduct. As good public policy, the burden to compensate this victim should be with the perpetrator of the crime. There are only two places where this burden for the financial harm caused by crime can lie, either with the victim or with the offender. With judgments having a life of many years, it's not possible for the court, quite frankly, to determine what assets may come the way of any perpetrator. Whether it's 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road, no one has the crystal ball to know what assets might come to a perpetrator of crime. It is, however, possible for the court to clearly place the burden for financial harm on the perpetrator of that criminal act. And again, that's what the victim is expecting from our judicial system. House Bill 2232 asks that even when there is a finding of guilty except for insanity, that the court treat this as a conviction for the purpose of recognizing a monetary obligation only, thus providing a method for imposing a formal restitution judgment upon the defendant and acknowledging the financial harm to the victim. Again, we request your support of House Bill 2232.
Thank you. Any questions from the...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss, and I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2232. House Bill 2232 provides that a person who is found guilty, except for insanity, will provide restitution for their victims of economic loss. The current law, as stated in State v. Giles, which I have, the citation of which I put into my written testimony, is that a finding of guilty except for insanity is not a conviction that would support a restitution award if the victim has suffered an economic loss. House Bill 2232 would correct that law for the narrow purpose of an award of restitution. The same acts, if committed by a person who was sane, would be compensated. As Ms. Gallagher stated, the defendant or the person who is found guilty but insane, but for insanity, may receive an inheritance, a tribal allotment, or become gainfully employed later on in their lives. It is unfair that the victim of crime would not be compensated in those events. I'd be pleased to entertain any questions.
Okay, any questions?
Well, again,
Representative Carson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, is there any reason to expect that the experience with collection of restitution judgments will be different from those who are not guilty by reason of insanity? I realize we don't have that mechanism here now, but based on the analysis done by the task force, is there a belief that it will be any different from the experience of the general population of offenders?
I have seen no reason to believe there would be different. The guilty but for insanity means that they were at the time they committed their act were not sane, but that doesn't mean that they weren't later on to could not be gainfully employed or after medical intervention become gainfully employed. So I have not, though, seen any statistical analysis of collection efforts towards people who fall into that category, primarily because there have not been collection efforts towards those people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And maybe you could answer, there's been concern that the word conviction is in here. And if I'm reading this correctly in 5, it says underlying for the purposes it gives the ORSs, which are the restitution statutes. Is that correct? So that somebody who's not guilty, is that the right word, not guilty, except for insanity, is really not convicted. They're not guilty, but then this conviction is merely for the restitution.
Mr. Chair, yes. In 5, the intent was in delineating those ORS provisions. Those are the provisions that are focused on the process of assessing restitution and the unitary assessment. For example, 137.106 deals with the process of restitution. 209 is the unitary assessment. 293, the monetary obligations, and so on, solely focusing on cost. It is not the intent of this particular bill that this be a judgment of conviction for any other purpose than for the monetary cost.
Ms. Moore?
Any three of you could answer this, actually. Is it possible that instead of using the word conviction then in this statute, that the language simply say, even in the instances of a guilty except for insanity finding, the court shall order restitution if restitution is asked for or requested by the state and the victim?
That would or could accomplish, Chair, Council, that could accomplish the goal except for the ability to collect flows from from the judgment itself. So simply saying a award of a restitution is not going to get us the ability to have the remedies, collecting remedies.
So if the statute read, the court shall enter a judgment in the amount requested, would that, I mean, I don't know, because I have not done civil enforcement law, I don't know if that would handle the issue.
Chair, Council, what we are seeking is a monetary judgment in order to enforce a monetary judgment. There is no ulterior motive to provide a conviction for any other purpose than simply to obtain a judgment so that we can enforce on behalf of the victim the monetary judgment.
Okay, thank you. Mr.
Beckelon. Again, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name's Walt Beckelon, the Marion County District Attorney, and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. House Bill 2232 enables restitution and assessments on a defendant's judged guilty except for insanity under that particular ORS 161.325. I guess I'd want to make it clear that this revision does not present a barrier for a defendant to utilize the mental disease or defect statute. Nor does it create an exceptional or unfounded obligation on those found guilty except for insanity. The statute has existing provisions that recognize victims' rights, notice, and DNA requirements. The state, through the PSRB, Psychiatric Review Board, can and does set reasonable conditions, and restitution ought to be one of those. The concept acknowledges the capacity of a defendant to contribute, particularly with mental disease or defect, if they're found at the time they committed the offense, that may no longer exist later on. And that is exactly what we're seeking to do. In my county, we see this all the time. Once an individual is stabilized and able to aid and assist their attorney, able to appreciate the wrongfulness of their conduct, move forward, restitution should flow from that concept down the road in terms of making victims whole.
Questions? Thank you. Mr. Morris, Ms. Skye, and Ms. Buckley, and then there'll be one more witness after that. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, my name is Mike Morris, and I am the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I apologize for not having written testimony for you this morning, and we will prepare that for you and have that to you soon. But I do want to take the opportunity to, for the record, to testify in opposition to this bill. For the reason is that if there is a judgment of restitution payments, that individuals who are under the supervision of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and are at the Oregon State Hospital, if they have this judgment, then the little funds that they do have will then need to go towards the restitution and payment, and thus make it more difficult for us to then discharge them into the community because they won't have the funds for rent, et cetera. Two things will happen. One is it will slow down the discharge process, and currently we are 56 over budgeted capacity at the Oregon State Hospital due to difficulty discharging folks to the community. The other aspect of it is that if they do not have the funds to support themselves out in the community with housing, then the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services will then use general funds to pay for their housing out in the community. So there, we are in the process of trying to estimate a fiscal impact on this, but there is likely some fiscal impact. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and appear today before you to oppose House Bill 2232 for a number of reasons. First of all, on a basically a philosophical basis, I think when the Attorney General's office is talking about fundamental issues and concepts, the one that I think also needs to be considered is the fundamental concept of the insanity defense itself. It is a longstanding tradition that and a public policy that individuals who commit crimes as a result of their mental disease or defect are treated differently in our society than, and in this state, than those who commit crimes as a result of either antisocial conduct or what have you. I think this the legislature, the Oregon legislature, has maintained this even over the course of time when the nomenclature of the defense was actually changed. Prior to 1983, you may recall that the defense was called not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. And then subsequent to the Hinckley case, when most jurisdictions were reviewing their insanity statutes, the Oregon legislature did change the name of the statute to guilty except for insanity to reflect some accountability and responsibility. But the legislative history will show you that there was not to be any substantive change, and that prior to 1983 it was considered an acquittal, and still to this day is considered an acquittal, in that it is not a conviction. I will submit to you that there were some cases in the 90s with in the Court of Appeals that had some dicta that raised a question about that. But most recently, in the case that you have of State v. Guile, the court found that it was not a conviction for purposes of fees and assessments. And even more recently, in the case of State v. Saunders, the court has held that it is not a conviction, period. And so I think this bill would, first of all, change that long history. And despite the fact that they indicate that that's, you know, not their intent, I think when you call it a conviction for one purpose, it's hard not to say it's a conviction for other purposes, or for people not to think about it in that way. And to that end, my second concern is the unintended consequences it may have for our system in general. I believe that the more that one characterizes our clientele as having convictions, the more fodder you provide to those opponents in the community who object to our current efforts to find places in the community for these individuals to live. I can tell you I have been involved with staff of Mr. Morris's office in a very intense effort at this in this biennium to develop community placements for our clients, and it is a awesome task given the stigma that our clients suffer with members of the public. You know, frankly, in the course of going through the state and trying to develop these placements, there has not been one situation yet that we've had that we haven't encountered community opposition to our siting. And what we rely most on when discussing this with individuals or neighborhood associations, what have you, is the fact that for residential treatment homes and adult foster homes, these are basically covered by the Federal Fair Housing Act. And I think the danger we have here is that the more you make, and the Fair Housing Act, as you well know, does not apply to criminals. It protects people who have mental disease or defect or disabilities. And so the more that we make this seem like it is a conviction, I think the greater their argument may become that, in fact, these are more criminals than persons with disabilities, and thus they will challenge every effort that we are making to place these people in the community where they belong. My third concern, frankly, is on a practical matter. And as Ms. Sky mentioned earlier, you know, it's my experience that you can't get blood from a turnip. I will tell you that most of our clients are, the vast majority of our clients are indigent. Their sole source of income is SSI check or an SSD check. And they basically can't afford you know, much of anything in this life, frankly. When they are placed in the community, the board usually, in most all cases, initially places them in supported environments, staffed 24/7, residential treatment facilities or treatment homes. And as a result of the laws that are currently in effect, that Social Security check goes to their cost of care as it is. So if they're in a residential treatment home, they don't even see their Social Security check. They're only entitled to $122 or $144, depending, for spending money for that month. So, you know, practically speaking, I'm not sure what this would do. I would also note that, you know, we're talking about a very small number of individuals in the greater scheme of things. We used to average maybe 55 to 60, even with our growth that we're currently experiencing. In 2004, there were only 126 individuals placed under our jurisdiction. So to change the whole, you know, fundamental concept of the insanity defense to make it easier for people to challenge the placement of our clients in communities for what I don't know what, in fact, they expect to get from our clients given their financial situation. You know, I would urge the committee that that is not worth the cost and that the benefits are far outweighed by the cost, and would ask you not to pass this bill. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Buckley, the way I understand the proposal of this bill would be that, for example, paranoid schizophrenia beats my old Mercedes that's only worth $30,000. I knew it's worth a lot more now. And I don't have a Mercedes. Then their parents die, and even if they're in the hospital or not, and so then they receive some kind of a, you know, inheritance. Why should I not be made whole with that? Would be my question. Why should not, you know, I don't think windfall is the right term, but they receive an inheritance. I'm out, whatever, for the damage they did to me. Why shouldn't that I get paid for that? Why should I not be eligible for that?
Chair Buck, I wouldn't say that you shouldn't be eligible. I just think that we should explore other ways that this might be possible rather than calling it a conviction and using this mechanism. You know, in my experience at the board for the years that I've been there, you know, it's a rare thing that our clients are fortunate enough to win a lottery you know, oftentimes if they have any, if family members, if they were going to inherit those resources are put into special needs trusts so that, you know, they don't jeopardize their entitlements and are only used for the things that they couldn't, you know, afford with their, you know, spending money. But, you know, I don't mean to, you know, belittle the victim. I understand that, you know, that they may not understand, but I think it's fundamental to our system of justice that the public does understand that there is a difference between individuals who commit crimes as a result of their mental disease or defect. It was not an intentional act. They would not, I mean, the fundamental premise is they would not have victimized this individual, but for the fact that they suffered from a mental disease or defect that over which they had no control, I mean, which is not, you know, something that they had, you know, any way of avoiding. I mean, this is, you know, the basically what they've been given in life. And so, I mean, I would urge the parties to maybe look into whether there is some other mechanism to use, because as they say, once you start conviction, I just don't think that, you know, you can, if people think of it, you know, it may be a distinction without a difference when people talk about it. Oh, it's a conviction, but only for this purpose. I don't think that's usually the understanding. Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Skye.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I don't have a lot to add. Ms. Buckley very well summarized my concerns with the bill, and many of them also go along with the concerns that I expressed on the bill previous. I do think that Bob Junedef with the Oregon Advocacy Center is here and available to talk. I don't think that he got an opportunity to sign up to testify, but he is another person who objects to this bill.
Okay.
I have some questions for this panel here before they will leave the witness box here. This is a question I think I'll put to Mr. Morris and Ms. Buckley, and you can decide who will respond. I want to pursue that question about the impact on release of people from a facility. And we have two populations we're dealing with. We have the population that's in the general prison population who are now subject to restitution obligations, and they accumulate certain funds when they're incarcerated. And I don't. One question, maybe to weave into your or answer, to weave into your response, would be whether you know whether those people have the funds that they were accumulating that helped them transition out of the institutional setting being drawn away for restitution, and then to compare that situation then with the population who are in a facility for the mentally ill, and how those are different. That is, do we already have this problem with restitution, that funds that are being used to help transition people out of an institutional setting are being taken for restitution in our general population, and if not, then how is it different in the insanity situation?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, one of the differences is my understanding of the correction system is in regards to their release is in regards to a time based on period of time as well as maybe behavior and conduct, and that's determines when they're being released. When individuals are under the Psychiatric Security Review Board at the state hospital, their release is based upon, one, is their ability, their stabilization of their mental illness, and that they are doing better, but also on the fact of whether there are the resources and for that individual to return to the community, and if we can provide the supports necessary for those individuals. So anything that hinders our ability to provide those supports in the community is going to slow down the process of those individuals being released into the community. We have an obligation to pay for their care and treatment in the community if they do not have the means to do so.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that there's a fiscal impact analysis that's being prepared.
Yes.
When would we expect we'll have that?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I anticipate that before the end of the week that we will have that to you.
Okay. The question for Ms. Sky, if I could. focusing again on that distinction of just drawing between the general, the population that would be serving time in the general Department of Corrections facilities and those who then would avail themselves of an insanity defense. If we continue this distinction between those who are in the general population who owe restitution and those who are use the insanity defense and will not owe restitution if this bill isn't passed, could that or does that impact pleading decisions? That is, if somebody causes a very high dollar impact kind of loss, would their decision to use the insanity defense be affected by the fact they wouldn't owe restitution? Do you see any plausibility in it affecting that kind of dynamic?
And Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I would say no. And I've been a public defender for 11 years and represented a number of people who've made the decision or not made the decision to seek an insanity defense. And it's really generally more affected, that decision is really more impacted by where is this person more properly placed? Do they belong in the hospital or do they belong in prison? And in my profession, I advise the person as to whether that defense is available. And sometimes I get clients who say, I don't want to go to the state hospital. I'd rather go to prison, even though I've hired an expert who's evaluated them, who has said this person qualifies. Other clients, I generally will always have the person evaluated for the defense if I think that it may apply, if I know that the person suffers from a mental disease or defect, because I would not be an effective lawyer if I didn't know, have the opinion of an expert as to whether it applied. And then generally I will advise my client, and it is their decision whether to assert the defense or not. It's not my decision. I can't assert it without their consent. But I will advise them as to the different consequences. Never once have I advised them that they're not going to be held responsible for restitution. And admittedly, a part of that is because the law used to say that the court could consider their ability to pay. And if I was telling a person that they meet the criteria for an insanity defense, I work at the public defender's office, so I have never advised somebody that they're going to owe money. And I can't imagine a circumstance where that would be a factor. It really has more to do with where is the proper placement for this person, and should they be held accountable for this conduct, or are they ill? Do they have a mental illness or a disability? That, and that's a mental defect. And what we're talking about here is developmental disability, autism, mental retardation. Those are the things that we consider in advising a client, and it's the client's decision. And many clients choose not to do that because they don't want to go to the state hospital because they know that they're going to get wrapped up in the system longer than they will if they go to the Department of Corrections. And that is true, especially at the higher level offenses. So I can't imagine that being a reason why a person would choose to go that route.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Mr. Jude, if you'd like to.
Juna?
Junda.
Junda. And Ms. Quinteros also, if you'd like to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me up today. My name is Bob Junedeff, and I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. We are an organization that advocates for folks with disabilities, in this context, people in Oregon State Hospital. We do not provide criminal defense and don't get involved in criminal cases. Really, I think the point I wanted to address with you today is that I think that what you are weighing today is a sense of justice. Is there justice in a crime victim being compensated for something that is done for a loss that they've suffered as a result of someone who was psychotic at the time that they committed the act, is it just to require that person to pay for whatever harm that they may have caused while they were psychotic and committed an act? What I would submit to you is that the entire reason that we have an insanity defense is because society has recognized that it is unjust to penalize a person for an act that they commit while in a condition that they cannot, where they cannot control their behavior. This is a long-standing thing that society has done, and that is why instead of punishing folks by sending them to the penitentiary, we send them for treatments at great state expense, I might add, at the state hospital. What I would liken it to is a victim of a natural disaster, something that occurs. In the case, it's not a tsunami, it's not a hurricane, but what it is, it's that a disease overtaking an individual and causing him to act in a particular way that's destructive and needs to be controlled, and society needs to step in. But what steps do we take from there? The policy behind restitution, as I would understand it, is that the court is able, at the point of the conviction, to assign an obligation on the person who's committed the crime, because the court has found that that person intentionally or recklessly caused the harm. So likening it to a civil proceeding in which there's been a finding that a person did something, they've committed a wrong, and they should be responsible for it. However, when a person has gone through an insanity defense, it's really a different equation, because you never get to that point. You don't get to the equivalent of a civil judgment, because you don't have an individual there who has intentionally caused something to happen. And so there's a natural next step that they should pay for that to happen. Really, what you're considering is more of a situation where something's happened that nobody could control, and now the question is who pays for it. Is it fair? Is it fair for that individual who had no control to pay for it? Is it fair for the victim to have to bear the burden of that? Should somehow the government step in and make that person whole? Should we look to an insurance company? Where do we look? What I would submit to you is that, yes, it is an injustice if a crime victim has suffered in this way, but to create the equivalent of a civil obligation on a person who had absolutely no control over their behavior at the time is not just. The crime victim does have another alternative, of course, and that is to seek relief through the civil courts. And I, frankly, can imagine situations in which that would be appropriate. But it wouldn't be appropriate in every case. There may be a person who bears some burden of fault because, let's say, while they were competent, they decided to go off their medications and became psychotic and unable to control their behavior. But that certainly isn't the situation in every case. Civil courts are uniquely designed to weigh all the facts that might come up in a situation like that and award damages if they're appropriate. So I would just ask you to consider some of those factors in weighing the justice for all the people involved in the situation. The other points that have been raised, I think, are not insignificant, is that we do have a crisis at our state hospital. For one reason or another, that hospital is significantly overfull. I can tell you personally that we have worked on the legal end of creating community placements for the folks that are in that institution. Right now, what they are telling us, that the hospital is telling us, is that if they had appropriate community facilities, they could move half of the people out of that institution. But right now, there's significant impediments to doing so. They also tell us that that would be medically more appropriate for those people, so that those people would get better faster, benefit more at less public expense if they did that. I agree with Ms. Buckley that you may be inadvertently creating more barriers to to the state being able to appropriately place people. The last point I would like to make is that right now, if a person does, when a person goes to the state hospital, there is an entire state process for determining their ability to pay for their own care, and they are obligated to pay for their own care if they have those resources. Award that of restitution or paying for court costs or public defender costs or the other things that are covered in this bill will, of course, take money from the state of Oregon, because those funds go into the general fund and they will be reallocated, and that may be an implication that you haven't considered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, my name is Terry Quinteros. I'm the Program Director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety, which is a program of the Western Prison Project. At Crime Survivors for Community Safety, we work with folks who identify as victims of crime and violence and also help do organizing to help prevent future crime. And we are here today to oppose this bill. We believe that this bill does not actually help keep people safe, that in fact, in I agree greatly with Ms. Buckley and Ms. Skye's testimony earlier, that it only creates additional barriers for people in enabling them to live their life safely, being that we believe that if this bill passes, that it could put up an additional barrier regarding housing for people who identify as having a mental illness, and that does not help keep anyone safe, that only puts more people at risk, and that an unintended consequence of this bill would be that it would put more people at risk for homelessness. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Harris Matarazzo. I'm an attorney, and I represent the vast majority, maybe most all, individuals who are under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, and I have done so for a number of years. I have a little bit of expertise in this matter. I would mirror the opposition noted by the previous witnesses and just add that one of the concerns not mentioned is that anything that would make an individual who has successfully employed an insanity defense and has done well at the state hospital in terms of treatment and then has progressed back out in the community. Conviction issues often come up in my area where a client who's doing very, very well has to apply for employment. And I have a couple of clients now who are actually state or county employees who and are doing very, very well, but the issue, this issue of whether or not it's a conviction comes up quite a bit, and even though doing a good job, they can lose their jobs. And I believe that anything, any bill such as this, which makes the law look more like a conviction, makes the defense look more like a conviction, will be harmful to them. And then certainly I think the idea behind the whole PSRB system is to get people out in the community and functioning well and safely and to be good citizens. Again, I would also reiterate the housing issues of placing people in the community people who otherwise can actually be successfully placed, and barriers to those sorts of things should be reduced and not created. And as Mr. Jundeff indicated, the cost of care issue, right now clients are billed approximately $11,000 per month for the cost of care at the state hospital. So to the extent that they have any of those resources, they are taken by the state through a formula. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2232. We're not going to move this one forward today. I'd like to get that financial statement that somebody had also, Ms. Moore, if you would take a look at, if you could do something about the language, it seems to be a great concern, and then we can revisit this. Next bill up is House Bill 2233. I'll open the public hearing.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of Crime Victims Assistance for the Oregon Department of Justice. House Bill 2233 is a straightforward bill that requests that the life of a criminal restitution judgment be extended from the current 20 years to 50 years. When we look at what the data shows us about criminal behavior, we see that the age range of 25 to 30 has the greatest number of offenders. This is actually based on arrests rather than convictions. In 20 years, a victim whose perpetrator has not paid off his judgment may find that it's expired, while the perpetrator, of course, still may have many years of productive life where he may be employed or have other types of asset acquisition. A period of 50 years for the life of a restitution judgment will be a positive step towards assisting victims in obtaining their right for restitution from the financial harm that's caused by a criminal act. So again, we request your support of House Bill 2233. I would also like to mention again that Crime Victims United also supports this bill as they did 2231. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, the panel?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss, and I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2233. This House bill is also a product of the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. It extends the period of time for collecting a criminal money judgment from 20 years to 50 years. This allows a greater chance for the victim to receive a full recovery of restitution. As Ms. Gallagher testified, many defendants are young when they commit a crime. Presently, most of them will be reaching their full earning potential just when the judgment remedies expire. This extension of time from 20 to 50 years would also allow a greater opportunity for the victim to receive compensation through an inheritance, through the recovery by the defendant of an inheritance from their parents. In addition, prisoners who are sentenced to prison will, if it's for more than 20 years, when they get out, their judgment would have expired. We urge you to extend the period of time to allow a collection of for up to 50 years.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. This is the final in a trio of strong refinements. We support this bill. It highlights accountability, the windfall situation, and a change of circumstances. And I recommend that this move forward.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question, I think, probably goes best to Mr. Boss. And as I alerted you the other day, I need to know about the rate of interest that applies to a restitution judgment, because we're just extending under this proposal so much longer the period of time in which the interest would accumulate. Is it the 9% statutory rate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, yes. It ORS 137-183 allows for the rate of 9% per annum on criminal judgments. The note in the ORS is that this has the effect of this particular statute has been deferred to July of 2007. So it, presently, criminal judgments are not earning interest. They will after July 1st of 2007.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Has there been any thought in as part of this analysis of this very extended period for in which interest would accumulate once that interest factor takes effect of adjusting the rate so that it reflects a true market rate of interest?
The bill, as Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, the bill as presently written does not have an adjustment for a market rate over that extended period of time. The present 9% per annum is over the market rate, is my understanding, and is designed both on the civil and the criminal side to provide an incentive for early payment.
Mr. Chair, if I could, it isn't a question, it's a comment, but the theory of restitution is to try to, as effectively as we can, to quantify the economic consequences of the criminal misconduct. And to the extent that we use an overstated rate of interest, especially when it projects out over a long period of time, we're introducing something else into the mix that's in the nature of punishment, or, as you just indicated, incentive for early payment, and that's really a different dynamic. So that I think that it's quite troublesome. If you took a 9% rate on even a fairly modest restitution obligation today, and you project that out over 50 years, you'd get to a sum that could be quite staggering, and I think many times the true economic quantification of the loss carried forward. Financial analysts go through that kind of discounting process and accumulation process all the time. So I would urge you to stir that into the mix to try to make sure we're quantifying effectively what the loss has been if we're going to extend the obligation so much longer.
Yes, we can consider that, Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on 2233?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Terry Quinteros. I'm the Program Director of Crime Survivors for Community Safety. And we are here today to support this particular bill. We actually believe in restitution and do believe that it is a way for someone convicted of a crime to actually start to repair some of the harm that they have created in someone else's life, not only financially, but also to have some sort of emotional connection with that person. We believe that extending this to 50 years would actually give that person convicted of a crime the opportunity to continue paying back restitution, as often it is a very large sum of money.
Thank you. That's fine. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Quinteros.
What I'd like to do is work with the OJ on the interest issue.
Okay, we'll do that. And then, okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2233. I'm going to ask counsel and Representative McPherson to work with DOJ with regard to the interest thing so that somebody pays off a reasonable amount, this sounds like a retirement system where the accumulations can just really get so high that nobody could ever fulfill that obligation. Next bill, open the hearing on House Bill 2337, Representative Crummell.
Do you want me to just go ahead, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. And I am missing Judiciary Committee so much from last session that I thought I should make at least one appearance here, although with some of the bills that I've sponsored this year, there may be many more to come. House Bill 2337, you'll note, Mr. Chair, was drafted at the request of Terry McDonald, and he's from Wilsonville. He's on my right here, and I'll ask him to say a few words after I finished. So this was a bill that was his idea as a creative way of trying to help fund some of our school programs. There's kind of a carrot and stick approach, if you will, for setting aside convictions of certain crimes, and this bill only applies to Class C felonies and then Class A, B, and C misdemeanors, and not any kind of crime that would be violent. Currently, there is a 3-year waiting period for filing for an expungement, and I guess I should mention that that's what this bill does, is that it expedites the expungement of the criminal acts that I was just mentioning, Class C felony and so on. It would reduce the waiting period for setting aside a conviction to less than 3 years. And then instead of having just the $80 that goes to that currently goes to the Oregon State Police, it would send some dollars to the state school fund. And the purpose in this is that, you know, the very people that could use after-school programs, when we're looking at our school system, that could use after-school programs such as music and art and athletics and some of these other things, there's a pay-to-play fee that most of our school districts are charging. And so the people that can many times benefit the most from having some after-school direction are the ones that absolutely can't afford it. And so we, you know, and every school district will say, well, there is a, we have a scholarship fund for those kids. Well, the problem with that is that you might have a number of kids out there that don't want, because it's viewed as being charity, may not want to go and get charity. I would love to see our school districts get rid of the pay-to-play type of policies that they have instituted over the last 10 to 15 years. And I view this as being a way of doing that. And there's a nexus between kids having after-school activities and they're getting involved in whether they get involved in crime or whether they get involved in meaningful type of activities that can help further them and round them out as people. So what I see this bill is doing is aiding that, because it actually spells out in the bill that when a person pays their expungement fee, and right now in the bill it's at $500, that $120 would go to Oregon State Police and the other $380 would go to the state school fund. And it lays out that the money has to go towards physical education, health education, music, arts, civics, and athletics. So those are programs that are desperately needed, in my view, in the school system. Now, I recognize that there may be some pushback from a variety of folks on this bill for a variety of reasons. I'm not here to say that this bill is, you know, the way it is right now is the way it has to be and that sort of thing. So I'm willing to work with folks if they would like to work with us. I know that there's one of the things that's a concern, particularly for the poor, is the fee being set at $500. If that's too much, and in the wisdom of this committee, you feel that it's too much and should be reduced, I have no problem in working with you on a what would might be considered a more reasonable type of fee, and how those fees are then split out. With that, I think what I'll do is I'll stop and let with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, let Mr. McDonald say a few words, and then see what other folks have to say, and I stand ready to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, does anybody have any questions at this point? Okay, please go ahead.
Honorable Chair Barker, respected ladies and gentlemen, representatives. My name is Terry McDonald. I am a constituent of Mr. Crummell. And the idea came to get this bill passed because the schools in Oregon are in desperate and hard financial problems. There was if you watch the news, there was a statement by one of the higher-ranking intel, which employs innumerable amount of people throughout the Oregon area. They will stay in Oregon if they find qualified people. Where are we going to get the qualified people from our education system? Okay. So how do we do this? There's a cost-benefit analysis. Okay. On all, just about every application I've ever seen for employment, they ask, what is your criminal record? Some ask only for felonies, but generally now they ask for the misdemeanors. Okay. Oftentimes, if the person would put the conviction, they're immediately barred from employment. What is the real cost of employment? What is the cost of welfare to the state on a non-employee person? How much tax revenue is really lost when a person is unemployed? What is the externalities of unemployment? Depression? A lot of cases alcohol, some cases drugs, spousal abuse. Unemployment is just mentally draining. all of these above and aforementioned social programs would be better utilized in a more productive fashion if the person was back in the workforce and as a taxpayer. Another concern I have is the length of time it takes to actually process this paperwork. After the paperwork is submitted, it can be up to a year before the final process is completed. Okay, further hindering the person's becoming a viable taxpaying citizen once again, contributing to the state budget. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Do you have any idea how many, what kind of a return this might have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. No. I have not taken this into legislative revenue and asked them to look at it from a standpoint of what the impact on revenue would be in terms of how much revenue it would bring in. I also have not, asked the various departments what the fiscal impact would be on administering this, but I can't see the fiscal impact on administering it going up, considering that, we already have this type of a program in place.
Okay, thank you. Any yes, Representative.
So on, with this bill, are you anticipating that you will speed up the process? Is that the point? Is that one of the points besides school fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, I think there's a couple of things here. One is yes, it would speed up the process for some because your lower level crimes, class C misdemeanors, for example, would go. You could have them expunged after 1 year as opposed to being waiting a full 3 years. So it would speed that up. Now, from a standpoint of whether or not it would speed up the paperwork working through the system or not, I don't know. I think that is a hope that Mr. McDonald has, is that it's something that would be sped up in terms of people being able to apply and get the paperwork part of it done quicker. I don't know, Terry, if you want to respond to that or not, feel free to.
Chairman Barker, respected Madam Thatcher, yes, I would like to also have this included. And if there is, the process is already in place to do this. If the area is so underfunded or underfunded with personnel and there's a high bubble of orders, you can always hire contractors. Contractors can be expanded and contracted at will. Okay, there's no extra costs as far as health insurance, any kind of insurance, or retirement with the contractors. They're expanded and contracted as needed. That is one solution. I would also like to say, how long do we continue to punish someone? Especially on your lower level crimes. They paid their fee. If they've gone through whatever else the court requires, they still have that 3-year process. That's still weighing over their head.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Mr. Reynolds, Ms. Skye, and Representative Shields. Representative Shields, you can go ahead anytime you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I've been working on
improving public safety for over 7 years in North Northeast Portland through Better People, the agency that I founded and was former executive director of. Better People's mission is to dramatically reduce recidivism, the rate at which offenders return to crime in Multnomah County and other areas. And I'm also state representative for District 43 in North Northeast Portland. I hadn't planned to testify this morning, but the $500 fee kind of caught my eye, and I thought I might make some comments about that. But after having listened to my colleague's testimony and the ideas behind it and getting a clear sense of it, I think it is kind of a neat idea. But I would like to just talk about, I guess, in more general terms of concerns that I have for fees and assessments that made me think of that. I'm concerned that we're getting to a point of diminishing returns with criminal fees and assessments, that we might get to a point where we're bringing in less money as we continue to put fees and assessments on offenders generally. And with this particular bill, I do have some concerns that the $500 might be, you know, not the perfect number, and that only people that have significant resources might be the ones who'd be able to take advantage of it. I think if Representative Crummell and Mr. McDonald, and I do appreciate them introducing the bill, it does seem like a neat idea, are open to maybe a -1 amendment to bring it down to what might be a more reasonable number, or allow people to pay it over time. I think that might be beneficial. And perhaps most importantly, we should keep a close eye on what happens to revenue from this particular fee down the road. And I do hope that we'll keep our eyes open for other ways that we can fund education through ways that are associated with the criminal justice system. And because I do think that restitution is very important, and I do believe that it should be a challenge for people to expunge their records, because it's an important way for people to accept responsibility for what they've done. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Skye?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Kelly Skye again with Orton Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I have submitted written testimony. Many of my concerns about the fee raise in this bill are the same as my concerns in the first bill, 2231, that being that we are placing expungement out of reach of the poor, and it's those folks, people who are living on the margins already, for whom a criminal conviction is the biggest barrier to employment and to housing. And in that respect, I do agree with Mr. McDonald, the proponent of this bill, that this criminal conviction can be a bar to someone moving on and bettering their situation. Raising the fee to $500 will place it out of range for many folks. As I said earlier, I have been a public defender for 11 years. Our office performs expungements for our clients. I checked with our expungement coordinator yesterday. She gave me some estimates of numbers. We receive 60 to 80 requests per month. Those people actually meet with an attorney or an assistant, and that person reviews their situation just to make an initial assessment of whether they are actually eligible. Frequently, they have a conviction in their past that will make them ineligible. But out of the 60 to 80 requests, 20 actually pay the $80 fee that's currently required and begin the process. Now, paying the $80 fee does not ensure that you're actually going to get your conviction expunged. All it does is allow you to apply. So then once the Oregon State Police runs your fingerprints, if something comes up in another state, then you may not be eligible. Or if it turns out that there's an outstanding financial obligation or something else that the attorney didn't know about, they're not going to be eligible. Not refundable, the $80. They have paid that fee to apply. Now we're talking about raising that fee to $500. In talking with our expungement coordinator, she said that she thinks our expungements will essentially dry up. She said, occasionally she gets a person who can pay the $80 the day that they come in, but for the most part, people leave, they save up, they come back to pay the $80 to file for expungement. So this will place it out of reach, and as Representative Shields mentioned, it probably will be diminishing returns, because those 20 people who are paying $80 now are not going to pay $500, so that's money that you're not going to be receiving, that you are currently receiving. And that said, I do support the first section of the bill, and we definitely support reducing the amount of time that's necessary to wait. And I would remind you on that aspect that this is one of the most confusing statutes in the criminal code, but to reduce it to plain English, you have to wait for 3 years after your conviction, but then at the point at which you are applying for expungement of that conviction, they look back 10 years, and you can't have anything else for 10 years except for the one conviction that you're looking to expunge. So these are people who have stayed out of trouble for a good amount of time, and reducing the amount of time that they have to wait for these lower-level offenses is probably a good idea. We just really are concerned about the $500 fee. Now, if there were a way to write in to the bill the ability of the court to waive that fee or to reduce it, we may be open for discussion, recognizing that there are some people who have the money to pay the $500. And, you know, we don't necessarily oppose that. It's just that the majority of people who are seeking to get these convictions expunged don't have $500.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know that you would have any reason to know the answer to this, but do you have any idea how many people apply in Multnomah County altogether in a month?
Chair Barker, I do not, and that would be something that the DA's office would be in a better position to answer.
And you don't know, I presume?
Chair Barker, I don't. I did correspond briefly with our expungement DA about 2231, but I did not talk to him about general numbers.
Okay, thank you. See, Mr. Reynolds.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I've submitted written testimony. My name is Robert Reynolds. I'm from Portland, and I'm appearing as a concerned citizen. As you understand, the measure raises the fee for request to set aside of conviction from $80 to $500, with $380 being dedicated to the school fund for certain restricted purposes. I think it's praiseworthy that there's an attempt made to augment the school fund, and also that there's an attempt made to shorten the time until expunction can be made possible for people who have satisfied their debt to society. Nevertheless, I think this bill contains three important defects, and two of them, I think, can't be remedied by amendment. I think it's the responsibility of all citizens to support schools. And I think it's important that they be supported in an equitable and proportional sort of way. And it's, I think, of course, the responsibility of the legislature to style equitable and proportionate ways for citizens to participate in the support of schools. This measure, however, supports schools by imposing a fee on people who are in a position of needing to do business with the state for one reason or another, and therefore I think is inequitable, because suddenly people who need to do certain kinds of business with the state are more responsible for supportive schools than citizens who don't have to do business with the state. And I think it's also arbitrary in the sense that not all persons put in the position of needing to do business with the state for that involves a fee are required to do this. For example, I don't know if it's the case still that it's necessary to pay a fee in connection with filing for running for public office, but if people who were required to pay a fee to run for public office were charged a supplemental fee for the school fund, I think they would feel that there was an arbitrariness and inequity associated with that that legislation. So the idea of using this mechanism to support the schools, I think, is problematic in itself. If the fee is imposed not on all persons who are required to pay fees to do business with the state, but just people, for example, who are trying to have convictions set aside, then it essentially amounts to additional punishment over and above the time that they've served or fines that they've paid or whatever has been the punishment. It's in the interest of the state to facilitate and to encourage expunction of record so that people can return to full citizenship and full productivity to the greatest extent that that can possibly be done. And I believe, as other people have testified, have said, that the additional fee, particularly a fee as large as $500, but in any case, the additional fee would serve as a hindrance and deterrent to carrying through that process. Finally, and this may seem irrelevant, but I think as a former educator, I think it's not really the dedication of these funds to only certain educational programs rather than the full range of educational programs has the implication that the funds, that the programs being funded are somehow second class. And I think it's not a good idea to send the citizens of Oregon the message that programs, educational programs in civics and art and music, should be funded only by supplemental means and not on a par with other kinds of programs. The point was made by the proposers that these are often after-school programs, but the although the athletic programs that are mentioned in the bill are after-school programs, I hope it's not the case that physical education and health and civics and art and music are relegated now entirely to after-school programs. So for all these reasons, I urge that you not support this measure. I'd be happy to answer questions if I can, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2337. We won't move this forward today. There's been a lot of really good points brought up, and I think we'll have another look at it. And Representative Cromwell, if you could maybe get some kind of a fiscal statement, that would be helpful, and if you get a hold of Ms. Mowat, we'll... And thank you. I want to thank everybody for bringing that in. Good job. The next bill up is Senate Bill 40. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 40.
Mr. Chair, as Ms. Buckley takes her seat. Mr. Prinz has a meeting to go to in 5 minutes on this prior to this bill, and just wanted me. Do you want to speak, or do you just want me to? Okay. Just wanted me to let the committee know that there's a lot of confusion about the fiscal impact in this bill, and so even if we move this out of committee today, I'm probably going to hold off on at least another week's worth of full committee hearings just to try and identify the confusion surrounding the fiscal impact of this bill.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. As I mentioned earlier, I'm sure you're aware that the board's clientele is continuing to grow at an unprecedented rate. This has had significant impact not only on the board but also on the other parts of the system as well, particularly the forensic units of Oregon State Hospital. To allay some concerns that have been raised that this growth is a result of inappropriate placements under the board's jurisdiction, the board examined its statutory scheme and type of clientele to see if any changes should be made to avoid that potentiality. Senate Bill 40 is one of the three concepts that the board submitted to address this issue. Now, given the current court challenges the board has faced, as well as the current thinking of the psychiatric community as a whole regarding sex offenders and the difficulties inherent in this population, the board decided to seek to exclude solely a paraphilia from the mental diseases or defects which qualify for the insanity defense. The disorder of paraphilia includes diagnoses of pedophilia, paraphilia, fetishism, and others that I think are listed on your counsel's notes. The purpose simply is to avoid inappropriate placements of individuals to the board and to the state hospital. The state hospital is not the appropriate treatment facility for these individuals. The limited resources of Oregon State Hospital need to be reserved and utilized for those who can benefit from hospital psychiatric services. I should tell you that in examining our data, this will not significantly impact the PSRB's population. Although this will only affect a very small number of persons, because most of our sex offenders are in fact duly diagnosed with either a developmental disability or a major mental illness, I did want to note my colleagues at the Department of Corrections concern that even if this only amounted to one or two additional cases, it does increase the problem that the Department of Correction now faces with regard to the issue of sex offender treatment at the institutions. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention because my understanding is that although the funds were eliminated from the DOC's budget for treatment, the mandate under 426 to treat individuals in the prison who are sex offenders remains. And so that is a concern of those, although they weren't going to oppose the bill, and I think that's one of the reasons that council has indicated we need to meet with Mr. Prince to discuss what the fiscal impact may be. Thank you. I didn't answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
See, Michael Morris.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I am, for the record, Mike Morris, and I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 40. Many of the points that Ms. Buckley brought up are the same points that we have in our office, in that we do believe that those who have solely the issue of paraphilia, that they that the state hospital is not the best and appropriate treatment setting for those individuals, and we would like to reserve the precious resources at the state hospital for those who truly have a major mental disorder. And I again thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you. Questions? Ready? Mr. Mahler, thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Matarazzo. Mr. Matarazzo, did you want to testify?
Yeah, that's me.
Okay. Right. So I'm looking out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Harris Matarazzo. As I mentioned earlier, I'm an attorney who works closely with mentally ill individuals in the mental health community. I've represented many, many hundreds of people before the Psychiatric Security Review Board for about 17 years, and have some familiarity with Oregon law right now, because as Ms. Buckley indicated, there are some challenges in the court right now regarding what is and is not a mental disease or defect. I noted in the sign-up today that I was opposed to this bill. I'm not opposed to it. I think it's a great thing, but I'm opposed to it in its current form. And if I can tell you my three reasons why. First, I think the language itself is a bit unclear. My fear is that it will enlarge the pool of persons who are able to assert an insanity defense and not reduce it as I think it's intended. And I suspect and fear that it will increase litigation on the issue of what is or is not a mental disease or defect. And if I might give you just a brief bit of history, in 1983 the legislature already considered this issue when it amended ORS 161.295 to eliminate personality disorders. At that time, the PSRB defined personality disorder as including substance abuse and substance dependency diagnoses, as well as substance-induced disorders, as well as sexual disorders like pedophilia, among other things. Since 1990, I've been involved in multiple appeals on the meaning of the personality disorder exclusion. Personality disorder is a term of art in the mental health community, and although it was defined to the legislature as including the things I just mentioned as well as a few other things, there was no reference to a particular source. And again, as a term of art, the mental health community and courts generally rely on what's called the DSM, or the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Disorders, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is kind of a Bible of diagnoses. The addition of DSM at the time of the 1983 amendment did not include the diagnoses which were described by the board. And this has created a great deal of confusion when the board said, we want to enact this personality disorder exclusion, this is what it means, enact this and we will eliminate sex offenders, we'll eliminate substance abuse and dependence disorders. And the legislature agreed with that and it was enacted.
As I mentioned, I've been involved in multiple appellate actions over a good period of time, and finally, and recently, in Beisringer versus PSRB, the Court of Appeals agreed to review the 1983 legislative history and found that the legislature intended the personality disorders to include the diagnoses, the kinds of diagnoses I've just mentioned. The drug and alcohol issue is currently being appealed to the Oregon Court, or Oregon Supreme Court. The board has advised me that it believes the drug and alcohol issues don't need to be addressed here because the Oregon Supreme Court is going to decide the issue. I don't have the faith that that will happen, not that I dispute the court's wanting to address it, but having just appeared on January 5th in this matter, the court said to the state representing the board, attorney representing the board, this is a matter for the legislature to address. And we can't be put in this position again and again and again. So I'm hoping, I think this bill really should take into account those other things. And again, the legislature really has already taken a position on it when it included these disorders, when it was told this is what a personality disorder is and all these things were included. I agree with the previous witnesses that have said that these kinds of placements are inappropriate for hospitalization. And so there's no dispute there. I think it's just a matter of the bill itself and trying to do things. Now, I do have, as currently proposed, I have a couple of points I'd like to make as well. Again, the board has used the word, or the bill uses the word paraphilia in excluding certain things. And a paraphilia, again, is a term of art. It's a term of art that's included in here. The problem is that when courts and mental health professionals refer to DSM, this changes based on one addition to the next. And what is a paraphilia today may not be a paraphilia tomorrow. And I think that's confusing. Really, when a law is enacted and somebody reads it, courts are going to be relying on it. It's something that should be pretty obvious on its face. And if it means to include DSM or something like that, then maybe the exact diagnosis need to be included. But as somebody, again, who's litigated this issue for years and years and years, I think clarity is important. And in reading the legislative history on this matter, and if you look at the Beisringer case, you'll know exactly what the legislature intended in 1983, and that's what the court found. I believe that what the legislature intended, and what a better term to use, I think paraphilia is a good term to use. I think also that the words sexual disorders, sexual conduct disorders, and gender identity disorders more appropriately talk about what it was that the legislature wanted to exclude. Again, I mentioned one of my points, depending on the addition of the DSM, the definition of paraphilia can change. And I would note that in previous editions of DSM, zoophilia, inappropriate attraction to animals, exists. It doesn't now because the editors just didn't include it or whatever. If that specific diagnosis were to come back, but in a non-paraphilia category, I find it hard to believe that that the legislature would not want to exclude that. So that's why I think a broader definition is important because, again, diagnoses change from addition to addition. At one time, if you can believe it, homosexuality was considered, was listed as a DSM-1, Axis-1 diagnosis. And if that were to come back into vogue and be placed in here, would the legislature want that included for use to maintain somebody at the hospital or to insert an insanity defense? I don't think so. My second point is that, again, the intent of the 1983 legislature was to exclude all sexual disorders. And to enact the paraphilia language alone, I think, would create a problem from an appellate level because the Supreme Court, I can hear them now saying to me or the Court of Appeals, Mr. Matarazzo, the legislature had the issue was raised and reviewed by the legislature, and guess what? They only talked about paraphilia. They didn't talk about other things that have since come up. And so we have to hold them to their word that paraphilia is what they meant. And so I think, again, relying on that term alone would be inappropriate, and you have the ability right now to remedy this issue. Finally, as written, I think the proposed amendment allows individuals with both a personality disorder and a paraphilia and paraphilia diagnoses alone to be diagnosed with a mental disease or defect. If you look at the law the way it's being proposed now, it says as proposed, an individual with an abnormality constituting solely a personality disorder or constituting solely a paraphilia does not have a mental disease or defect. Okay, that's what the law is being proposed. However, if that person is deemed to have both a paraphilia and a personality disorder diagnosis with nothing else, the individual could be deemed to have a mental disease or defect. The person would have neither solely a personality disorder nor solely a paraphilia. And I don't think that result is a reasonable one, nor do I think it's one that's intended. Again, it's been mentioned that in 1983, many states were reviewing their respective insanity defenses following the attempted assassination of President Reagan. As noted by the Court of Appeals in the Weiswanger case, the 83 Oregon legislature's intent in enacting the personality disorder exclusion is clear. The PSRB and the legislature wanted to limit the definition of mental disease or defect, and by so doing, they wanted to exclude individuals with criminal behavior-related disorders, drug and alcohol abuse and dependence-related disorders, and sexual conduct disorders from inserting an insanity defense or being held under the PSRB for such conditions. Given this, I think the bill should be amended, and I've given some language, but in addition to the statement, you know, under subsection 2 where it says, as used in this chapter, the term mental disease or defect does not include an abnormality, and it goes on, I would say it does not include abnormalities which, A, are manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct, or B, constitute solely one or more of the following. That would include 1, personality disorders, 2, paraphilias, 3, sexual disorders, 4, sexual conduct disorders, 5, gender identity disorders, and 6, drug or alcohol abuse, dependence, or induced disorders, other than those which have resulted in a significant and permanent mental defect. For example, somebody who has been using drugs or alcohol for years who has brain damage should be treated differently than somebody who's just alcoholic who recovers from that in an alcoholic stupor commits crime. And in fact, when the board was testifying before the legislature in 1983, it was saying, you know, we periodically have people that commit crimes when they're drunk, and we as the board think that this is inappropriate. We don't think these people belong under our jurisdiction and shouldn't be here. And this visits that same concept. So again, I think the policy is a good one. I think, though, that the legislature now, because it's being brought up, really has an opportunity to address this once and for all. We can eliminate a lot of litigation and implement what the legislature intended 22 years ago. Thank you.
What I'm going to ask you to do is if you would get in touch with Mr. O'Leary in the judiciary office. He'll be the attorney working on that case, and maybe we get this clarified, and then we'll move it forward. We'll not move it forward today because of the things brought up, also the financial question. So.
Okay, and I will work with the board as well on this issue because I think we'll
close the hearing on Senate Bill 40. And we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 204.
Members of the committee. My name is Dinah Vitalens. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Criminal Justice Division. This bill simply amends a good statute, which is simulating legal process, to insert a requirement that a person intend to harass, injure, or defraud another before they can be convicted. We have challenges in court that on Article 1, Section 8 grounds currently. We've won those, but we're worried about what will happen at the Court of Appeals. And I don't believe anybody opposes this amendment. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions? Anybody? Session. Simple motion on that one.
Go to work session.
Go to work session on Senate Bill 204.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 204 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
And Representative McPherson will carry that bill. No further business before judiciary. Committee's adjourned.